Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Skylar Wilson. He's a wilderness guide, eco-activist, and ceremonial facilitator with over 20 years of experience facilitating connections with the more-than-human world. Skylar is the co-founding director of the Order of the Sacred Earth and author of the book Order of the Sacred Earth, an interpretational and intergenerational vision of love and action with Matthew Fox and Jennifer Barrett Listig. He leads earth-based, participatory, peer-to-peer ceremonies and mentoring programs for teens and adults, including a soul initiation group for men and the cosmic mass. His email is skylarwilson@gmail.com, or you can visit www.orderofthesacredearth.org, orderofthesacredearth.org. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks, Derek. It's wonderful to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for coming. So you have for decades been facilitating wilderness rites of passage. What do you mean by rites of passage? What do you mean by wilderness? And what do you mean by you do a lot of work with soul initiation. So can you introduce us to all of those?
Sure. Yes, I'd love to. This is my favorite topic. And by wilderness, I just mean any place where the more than human world is more predominant, louder than the human world, the human voices, the human ideas, roads, buildings, etc. And by rites of passage, it's an idea that goes way back beyond Joseph Campbell. There's a few different places. A Dutch anthropologist wrote about it a lot. And for me, it's similar to what Bill Plotkin, what his work is now about. And he writes about it in Soulcraft. I really love that book. But my personal sense of rites of passage is that we are nothing but change. Change is happening all the time. And we have to catch up to that sometimes. And or all the time. And so it's about creating a space where we can be fully present to what is and what we are, and mirroring and directing an experience that brings about that connection to life and to the soul. And by what I mean by soul is similar to the way Thomas Berry sees it, the amazing theologian and ecological writer and thinker. He calls soul, it's the most basic biological organizing principle of a human being and also non-human beings, trees, animals, even what we consider inanimate objects. He and I would argue that everything is ensouled. The whole earth is ensouled and has an inner essence that needs to be brought out. And most of humanity is not living from that place, from that essential place. And so it takes some work, some inner work to bring that out. And that's why my activism work has gone in that direction. It's felt necessary to go to that place for myself in my own sustainability in showing up for the natural world and as well as for others.
So what would be the difference between living, I don't remember the exact language you use, living an ensouled life or living not in touch with one's ensouled being? What does that look like? How do you know?
Mm-hmm. It's difficult to answer that, of course, and especially in terms of how do you know. How I know for myself is when there's different judgments, different subpersonalities, different parts of myself that have been shaped by wounds, by what society has told me that I am, by my shaping, by my family, etc. And there's something deeper. There's something that comes through in dreams. It comes through when I access non-ordinary states of consciousness through exercise that takes me to the edge, or through breathing techniques, through sweating, through fasting, through plant medicines like Huachuma, which is a cactus from Peru. Those types of things bring bring me in touch with something deeper, which is also very simple and yet profound. It's a innate connection to everything that is, the earth, the cosmos, what's around me. And I'm very, very quick to forget it. I'm very quick to go into those patterns. So there's a certain level of practice and work that my life has been centered around, because that's what I need to remember it.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you to walk us through a hypothetical or a typical or an atypical, whatever you want, rite of passage, how this might work. So start us off with getting in a car at your home and driving to where you're going to go, or just wherever it starts. So I want you to do that in a moment, and then ending with being done with it, if that's possible. But before then, a word that I use sometimes is I talk about how a lot of people act out their unmetabolized trauma. And, I may have been traumatized at some point, and then I can act it out through various means, including abusing other people, or including allowing myself to be abused, or including whatever. And then I talk about metabolizing that trauma, and like Joseph Campbell talks about, with turning those journeys into gifts for your community, or like Judith Herman talks about, you will never be the same after a trauma, she says, but you can sort of transcend it such that I will never be the same, but now you go on what she and Robert J. Lifton call a survivor mission, where I now know what I like and what I don't like in the world, and I know that I want to help other people to not go through what horrible thing I had to go through. Is any of this having anything to do with what you're talking about? Is my metabolization slightly the same as your catching up to how life has affected you, or are we talking about different things?
I think it's similar. The way that I see trauma, I think that things are traumas because there's a predisposition to that trauma, which comes from the soul. I think that traumas are necessary. They're part of life. I have two sons, and the birth experience is nothing but trauma in many ways. So we start out with this big trauma. And I think that the difference between somebody who's living from trauma unconsciously and somebody who's gone into their trauma and fully experienced that wounded little part or big part, and loved it and incorporated it, reincorporated it, that has a lot to do with what a rite of passage is, in my opinion, but also what different methods of psychology also try to do. So there's lots of different angles that this work can be done. However, I do think that trauma is, I wouldn't say that I don't want people to experience trauma. I don't want people to experience trauma without having a way to reintegrate it, because I think that's what's making a world that where there's so many people acting from a cutoff place and rewounding and projecting that trauma onto the world. It's hard to see and feel the multifaceted, moving, changing, beautiful world that we live in when we're stuck in a defensive posture or a small part of ourselves. And I think it's inevitable that we will be doing that. And so it's kind of a constant mindfulness practice and work of coming together with others in ceremony. And in my experience, there's an element, you can do some of this work alone. And there's many non-human entities, beings that want to help, that are reaching out all the time to help us. And yet there's something, some part of it, like family systems therapy, that can't be reworked in a social way without other people, in my opinion.
So I wanted to jump into the rite of passage thing, but now I have another question first, which is, you've talked multiple times about the more than human, and maybe integrate this into the other question. You've talked multiple times about the more than human world, And then now, I guess I've sort of derailed us off to talking about therapy. And I'm going to ask you what sounds like an aggressive and offensive question, but it's really meant to be a softball. So why do we need nature in all this? Why can't we just sit in a therapist's office and discuss all this and go our merry way?
Good question. If human beings were the beginning and the end to what our purpose as humans is, it goes philosophical pretty quick for me. But it's for me philosophically, we are the earth, and we are the earth experiencing ourselves through the human. And so sitting in an office just with another human, closed off from the natural world, we're missing the resources, the joy of connecting with our much bigger body. And so it doesn't seem like a very efficient approach to me. I've been to psychologists, I've gotten counseling, it's helped a lot, and it's an important part of my process when I feel like there's a trigger or a trauma that's coming up again that I need some help with. So nothing against psychologists, but I have gotten much more healing from long experiences in nature, weeks, months, being with nature, being in nature, and forgetting myself in many ways in order to find myself as something much deeper and larger.
Okay, so let's say, before we get to the whole process of rite of passage, why would somebody contact you or anybody else who does these wilderness experiences, wilderness rites of passage? First off, what position would I be in? What would spark me to call you? And then take me through what happens from the start of that until we're sitting out under a redwood tree or under a Joshua tree, or we're hiking or whatever it is we're doing. And then take us through this whole process.
Mm-hmm. So it is hard to discuss it in a general way because everybody comes to it in their own way, in a different way. And that being said, I think there are some similarities. I would say the two main categories that I've seen and noticed is one is from a place of things aren't working. And I've gotten to see that there's some gaps in how I'm experiencing the world or how someone is experiencing the world. And then there's another side, which is I know that there's more, and I want the joy of experiencing that. And so sensing that there is this possibility, feeling, intuiting, or just rationally knowing that would be a cool experience to have, to go out with that intention and see what happens. And so I would say people come with a range of intentions, and the similarity is that there's a yearning somewhere inside of them. There's a yearning, and a lot of people come with a lot of knowledge about the natural world, a lot of experiences in nature, but they're missing that human component of as Maladoma Somé says, he's an African teacher that I've worked with, because he would come to my house through one of my housemates in Berkeley a lot of times for over 5 years. He would say there's no community without ritual. And what I think he means is to experience that community element, to know ourselves as human, we need the community. We've developed as human beings by being in tight groups. And so a lot of people have had these amazing experiences on their own, but they realize there's something missing, that they haven't experienced those depths with another person per se. And so that's another angle. And so the experience itself, whatever reason people come to it, we will start out, there's a few different formats, one for teenagers that's usually over the course of at least a year, sometimes a couple years, where I work with the same group over time. And that's just meeting regularly, and we build up to a wilderness experience where we go out for a week and we fast in nature. And so all this preparation work has happened, and with adults, it's less preparation because adults are usually busier, although that's arguable. Kids are pretty busy these days too. But so we do the preparation work, which is the work of just getting to know one another and feeling comfortable in the group and being holding things like council, hikes in nature, learning some primitive skills, learning how to just basic orientation, how to relate to nature to make sure we're on the same page. And then we start the journey. And so we'll all go out, carpool or rent a big van and go out to Death Valley or any number of places. I'm living in North Carolina now, so I've been researching some places around here. I haven't led one here yet, but so then we go out and we have councils. We do walks in nature, solos, to start to feel into the core question. As David White says, what shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against the future sky? So I think that's a perfect way to look at it. There's so it's starting to uncover and burn away some of these layers and start to get to the core around a fire, perhaps, and doing different practices to get to that core together, and then going out. So there's that threshold where we go out into the wilderness intentionally. And then there's the part where we're still preparing and gathering. And then there's the part where everyone goes on their own with those questions and sits for a period of time, at least a day. I found at least 36 hours and without food usually, although that's not necessary. It's not black or white. But then everyone comes back after that, and we check on everyone as well, and while they're out there, and everyone comes back, and then we do different practices to integrate. And then also once we're back from the experience, there's more practices to integrate. And so that's one of the experiences.
So you said sitting there for a day or for 36 hours, and that reminded me of something that I've thought about for so long, which is that the importance of boredom, really, or the importance of not a better way to say it would be importance of lack of distraction. That I have written so many of my books when it is so easy to not write a book because I'm going to turn on the TV and watch a basketball game. And I'm going to go on for a second. Sorry that when I was a kid, I learned very, very, very early never to tell my mom I was bored, because when I would tell my mom I was bored, she would say, "Great, go mow the lawn," or "Great, wash the dishes," or, you know, I learned to live with boredom and to not complain. And
beautiful.
And there's a difference between being bored in school when, you know, you're just watching the clock and waiting for the minutes to pass, or sitting. I'm sorry I'm taking so long, but what I'm trying to get at is there have been so many times where I will go out into the forest, and I don't mean to make this all woo-woo or anything, but I'll go out and I'll just, you know, sit down for a little while, and I might start getting bored and think, oh, I want to go back and check email, or I want to go back to the house and do this, or oh, I've got to wash the dishes, I've got to do all these chores. But if I sit through that, then after a time, there might be a germ of an idea for a story, and if I sit longer, that will turn into a sentence, and if I sit longer, it will turn into a paragraph. And my point is, here's what I'm trying to get at, and I should have just said this and shut up.
No, I love your story.
Thank you. Joseph Campbell had this great line about people of all times until the present, and he wrote this in the 50s, people of all times until the present have known that to have anything approaching a spiritual life, the first requirement is leisure.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean leisure to waste time. It means leisure to... So just please put me out of my misery and take over.
Oh, I just felt a wave of like heartbreaking sadness in my heart when you said that, because I can just feel how little leisure most of us have these days. And
which is that, you know, and it doesn't mean that you don't have to be doing anything, because 800 years ago where I live now, they would move between their summer and winter camps, and that would be, you know, they'd be 30 miles apart. So that's a couple days walk. So there would be a couple days where they're walking, telling stories, just chatting with the other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, or, you know, they could be out fishing and, I mean, catching salmon or smoking salmon. They could be doing something else, but still there is this long, long uninterrupted time. Okay, I'll shut up now. I promise.
No, I think there's... What do I want to say? I was having the image of these hunter-gatherers just shelling their nuts, you know, like cracking nuts and around a fire and singing. And the way that there's always something to do when you're out camping in the wilderness, there's always something to do, going to get water or cooking food, preparing food or making a shelter or remaking your shelter, et cetera. But there's a purpose to all of those things. And there's plenty of time in between while you're doing things. So it's kind of a combination of there's always stuff to do, but there, it feels like you're not doing anything in a way. That's been my experience. And so, and yet in our, there's something different about the work that most of us do in this day and age. And in terms of boredom, I see that as a defense within myself of it's a defense against experiencing the world. It's a defense against, it's a fear. It's a fear to go out of myself and actually experience what's happening around me. And it makes sense that there's so much of that these days. Most of the teenagers I work with will mention that. My 3.5-year-old has already learned the word and uses it a lot. And so I just ask him what that means for him. And he doesn't really know. But then I try to get him off of his computer, which unfortunately he already has a love for, which isn't all bad, but it is when he doesn't want to sit by the fire with me or go out in nature. But anyway, I'm kind of rambling, but I think boredom is an essential sign and step along the way that you're coming close to the stepping off point. And it's important to feel that discomfort. Well, everything, I'll just say one more thing. Everything
Please.
Important that I've ever done has involved some form of discomfort, usually a lot. And there's some point along the way, usually not very far into it, whether it's a run or leading some type of experience, where there's everything in me doesn't want to do it. And I just feel so much repulsion in my gut. I just don't want to do it. And that's how I know it's important and that I'm about to get somewhere. I'm about to step outside into the flow of life. And so I just wanted to say that.
Well, thank you so much for saying all that, because you said it much better than I was able to. That
I don't know about that.
That the thing I was trying to get at with the boredom is that I go out in the forest and I'll sit there, and then this boredom will take shape, and then it will almost become a little bit frantic. It's like, oh, you know, I'm and it's quite often soon after that there is a release, that it's like then suddenly, and I don't mean to be too cosmic about this or Hallmarky, but you know, soon after the boredom, I can start to see the tiny spiders, you know, who are walking along, or I can suddenly see the mushrooms that are literally the size of a pencil lead. And all of a sudden, instead of being bored, it's like the world has opened up. But that boredom, so you said it really well. It's a form of resistance that just sort of, it's almost like and then after the boredom comes this release when I suddenly start opening up and seeing all the magnificent life that's everywhere in even the tiniest spot. You know, I see a plant that is a quarter of an inch tall that I would never have noticed had I not sat there through it. Is this making sense?
Yes. Yeah, that's beautiful. And the truth is that there, everything's moving inside of us and around us all the time. And I think for a lot of people, myself included, sometimes that's scary. There's something, my ego or my conscious mind tries to pretend and project that that's not the case. And there's some stability around me. And it's usually that voice which is resisting my going into the spider world or whatever. But the more I do it, the less resistance there usually is. I mean, now I feel way more at home outside always. And it's the other way around for me, where when I'm inside it, I just yearn to be outside.
And what, sorry if this isn't a fair question, but what are you hoping, what are you hoping to accomplish, or what is somebody else who wants to undergo this hoping to accomplish might be the absolute wrong word, through this, what do you hope happens? What do you hope, whatever the word is, what hope might be a wrong word too. So take this scramble and turn it into something. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm glad that you used accomplish and that you used the word hope. And I have mixed emotions about both of those, because I think anything that's coming from the smaller self, the ego, or from our minds even, is going to be less than that which I would hope happens. And so there's no way for that part of myself per se, or somebody else's, to know what's going to happen from that place. And so in a way, like you alluded to, the hopes and the accomplishment, at some point they get dropped, because we realize that that's not the direction we're headed. And yet it is that beyond the hopes and accomplishments is the direction we're headed, which is a kind of transformation, or that is an overused word. However, it's a kind of change in direct innate experience of oneself and the world. And so it's hard to pinpoint what that is, because it's different for everyone and everyone's in their own stage of the process. And the reason I describe it as peer to peer is, we're each our own. We each know ourselves the best. I've had some people look at me and I feel like they know me better, and there's something they're mirroring, but it's ultimately me that's going to put that together and change or realize some deeper part of myself. So I guess it's ultimately what I hope to happens on Earth is our survival as a species. Only if it means that we become an earth-honoring, earth-nourishing presence on the planet. If not, I hope humanity disappears and the rest of life continues and in a healthy way. And but I believe there's at least millions of us people, I you included, who recognize that there is an innate beauty to the natural world. And maybe even the most beautiful, important thing is the natural world. And so anything that humans do needs to be in collaboration with that natural world and with the cosmos even too. I'm curious why you hesitated to go cosmic?
I think because, I mean, everything about my life and my work is based on my experience and perception, everything else that I love what you said about the world is ensouled. And, I guess I would, if I had to force myself into a religious box, it would be that I'm an animist. And I believe that the gods and goddesses, or the god process, the goddess process, whatever, I don't care what we call it, the mystery is in everything. And so I do have this really cosmic bent, but at the same time, we live and then we die, and we need to drink water in the meantime. And, you know, my mom died a couple years ago, and I live in a big forest. And one of the questions I was wondering as she was dying is, do these trees care that my mom is dying? And today, last night was a windstorm and a rainstorm. And today I was outside and I heard a tree fall in the forest, and, you know, just hear all the cracking and the ground shook when it hit. And, you know, I don't know which tree it was. And it was like a moment of sadness. And then I went on with my life. And I mean, things die. And so it's this combination of there is this profound larger thing. And then there is the almost banality of day-to-day existence the regularness, the dailiness is a better word than banality. So, I mean, we can talk about, oh, there's a spider, it's spider magic. You know, so many times I've had interactions with coyotes and people have said to me, oh, it's the coyote trickster. Well,
yeah,
maybe, but maybe it's just a coyote, you know?
Yeah.
I have a coyote who's living his day or her day, and they went back to their pack and they said, hey, I saw this human. And the other coyotes, one of them may have gone, oh, wow, there's human energy. And another one may have gone, nah, it's just a guy who's getting about his day.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I do. And there's a difference between the ordinary day-to-day and non-ordinary types of experiences, which so many people have had, myself included, which where you feel a kind of beyond the personal, transpersonal awareness, like where you're just more identified with the whole of Earth, cosmos, or whatever. That's been my experience. Or you're above your body, or where I'm very interested in how to integrate that into the day to day, like to see the sun and see it as a star amongst other stars. And, you know, and there's a kind of big picture that's also happening with the little picture at the same time.
Exactly. That's why I sort of, because it's hard to get language around this, because it is both. One of my favorite questions is, have you ever experienced a miracle? And we can talk about, oh my gosh, you know, this amazing thing where, oh, like I know somebody who drove through a landslide, literally. She's a rock slide coming down in the canyon, and her pickup has huge dents in the top of the cab, and she survived. She didn't have any problem. Okay. Yeah. So that's a miracle. But you want to see a miracle? Look at your hands, you know? Blood flowing through your veins. There are two dogs and a cat sitting here. They are miraculous. There's 30 plants around this room. They're miraculous. I'm looking outside. I mean, a tree itself is a miracle. So, but it's also day to day. So sorry to go on about this, but I think a problem is that we tend to think that miracles, I too really want to integrate the miraculous and cosmic with the mundane. We don't need to integrate. We need to integrate our perception of the miraculous and the mundane.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, like you said, our hands, everything is miraculous, and it is all a mystery. We have names for things. And it's also a human tendency to start to take things for granted, to limit the millions of different types of information that are coming at us, and to make a reality out of that. So it means that there is a part of us that functionally we need to function. We have to simplify things. And yet it's so important to step out of that regularly in nature, in ceremony, with plant teachers or whatever. As Aldous Huxley says, it's like when he was working with peyote or mescaline, it was like what it might be doing is we have this pattern that's been, you know, generations and generations in the making of seeing what we need to survive and making a reality based upon that. And while we're on this this, you know, plant medicine, our consciousness changes to where those patterns disappear, and we're able to see all these things around us that we don't normally see because of our patterning. It takes those, you know, the doors of perception are just opened. And I like that, because it's like, it's so obvious that there's way more to everything than we can ever see in any moment. And yet so often we just go about as if that's it, that the surface level of things is all there is. And then, you know, as a culture say, oh yeah, that's a dog, whatever. That's, you know, that's a car accident. Those are millions of people dying from starvation. Okay, whatever. You know, it's a way that we can function, because, you know, if we're always open in that way, then we would be completely dysfunctional at some level, which may be a good thing, but I don't know.
You know, Martin Buber said that in his book, I and Thou, that he said there are basically two types of relationships. There's I, you, which is a relationship, and I, it, which is you perceive the other as an object and you exploit it. And he said it is not possible to stay always in the world of I, you, or you would burn up. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just in town an hour and a half ago, and I cannot imagine that every person I saw on the street has a hobby and has aches and pains and has a life and loves people and hates people. It's like, I can't do that. It's just some dude walking down the street. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Martin Buber said that if you only remain in the world of I, it, you're not alive at all.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you brought that up, because that you also brought up animism, and it is exhausting. I remember in one of my sort of, I don't know if it was a psychotic break, a spiritual emergence or emergency or whatever, but I was just going around feeling everything. It was after I'd been in the desert for 6 months, working for the Bureau of Land Management, mapping tortoise holes. And I came back in, and I was in San Francisco, and I was just literally feeling everything and going crazy, because it was just too much. And that was one of those moments where I was like, okay, it is happening in this way around me, and I have to take care of myself and learn how to close my doors of perception or whatever. And when I'm in nature, I can do that, and it's sustainable. That's part of why I'm drawn to be there so much. But in the human world, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad you said that. And that reminded me of a phrase that I came up with in my 30s to describe, I think, what you're talking about. Was I was walking down a set of railroad tracks one day, and all of a sudden everything opened up, and I went into what I called an uninterrupted state of grace. Mm. And I could just suddenly experience the relationships between, you know, rain falling and soil receiving the rain and plants taking it up, and just everything. I saw how it fit together. And then I was able to maintain that for a little while, and then it went away. And that came back, has come back other times, but you're absolutely right. It will happen to me, especially in nature or with a person or people with whom I'm really comfortable. And then I have to turn it off when I go into a city.
Mm-hmm. And this is a really good segue into soul, because that most basic organizing principle that we each have, because when we're not connected to our soul, or in that moment when I was in San Francisco, I was just overwhelmed. And when I'm connected to my soul, there's a kind of telos, purpose, directionality to what to pay attention to and how. And I think a lot of ADD and et cetera is just a word for empathic overwhelm, because in this realm where we have all this information coming in, and kids, for instance, can't focus. You know, it's not a supportive environment for their soul. And so bringing people out into nature is a much better one for being able to listen and experience the outer world and the inner world at the same time, so that that relationship develops and flows and becomes ingrained enough that it's strong. And so I do think that there's times like a monk in a monastery where we need to go and do nothing but chop wood, carry water, meditate, just being with ourselves until that voice can become big enough, that pattern in us, to find its way into the larger family of things around us, the natural world, our human relationships. And there's very few ways that's being practiced in our world today.
So what is we have about 5 minutes left, and
this went fast.
It did. I'm sorry for that. We have actually about 8 minutes left. So, so let's pretend that you're sitting in or walking around in Death Valley or in a forest, or you're out with looking at desert tortoise habitat. And we evolved in nature. We evolved with all of these other beings around us. What am I trying to get at? Sorry to ask this way, but what do the plants say? What do the plants do? How do they? And I know it's going to be different for everybody. And I'm going to say one more thing, and then I'll just throw this mess at you, which is, one of my most ecstatic moments in my 20s was when I was living in North Idaho in my maybe 26, 27, and I was just out walking on a logging road in the National Forest, and I still to this day remember the specific slant of sunlight as I looked at a ridge of, and I saw pine trees silhouetted in the sunset, and I will never forget the peace of that moment. And I don't know. Okay, so take these, you know, and then one more thing, sorry, which is, I remember reading Felicitas Goodman talked about how she believes that we in modern times are ecstasy deprived. And we substitute drug and alcohol use, we substitute shopping, we substitute sex, we substitute any of which can make us ecstatic, but we substitute all of those for this primal experience of ecstasy. So can you talk about, what do the plants and animals do when you're out there? Ecstatic experience and those moments that are just frozen in our psyche forever of just utter beauty in the natural world.
Amazing. Amazing. Yes, I'm feeling it. So, When I'm in the natural world, so I'm in Death Valley right now, I'm walking around and the sun's just rising. It's a little cool. It's in the spring and there's flowers around, and there's a gentle breeze that's going through this canyon, this valley, and the birds are just starting to sweep across the sky, and the plants are swaying just nice and slow, and there's a sense that everything is being exactly as it should be. And any thought that I have about that is extra. And in the emptiness of that moment, in the spaciousness around even my own personal knowing that I'm there, is this kind of melting into an ecstatic sense of being with and a part of all that's right in front of me, that's in me. And walking around in that state, there's a way to listen and feel, and there's so much space around that I become lifted into that space and am held by it. And there's a kind of just simplicity to that, in a sense that I could die right now and feel completely held by everything, and that it's all right, and that this ecstatic spaciousness is in everything and is my home, is my most core reality, is me. And that goes away quick when I leave those spaces. I haven't learned how to be in that all the time. And yet I do believe that that's my natural state. That's my reference point. And so when I'm feeling overwhelmed and beaten down in my day-to-day life, it's like, all right, where is that right now? And sometimes I can get there just by closing my eyes for a minute and breathing. And other times I have to go back and go way out and listen again in the quiet of nature.
Thank you for that. That was perfect. And you can either go here or you don't have to go here if you don't want. We only have a couple minutes left. Before we started, you had mentioned, you had asked if it would be okay if we discussed plant medicine. And I said, sure. And then we didn't really. And do you want to for a couple minutes, or do you want to save that for another time?
I could go either way. Do you have a specific question about my relationship with plant medicine or anything like, let me think. I will say that that there's all kinds of ways to get to that place that we were just talking about. And I think there's many plants that in my experience are much more intelligent than us. And what I mean by that is that they know how to be themselves and be connected to everything. And so some of these, the plant that I work the most with is Huachuma or San Pedro, which is a cactus. It's legal in many parts of the world and illegal in some parts. And the experience there is like completely simple. It's a 12-hour journey, and it feels exactly like what I was just describing in Death Valley. So when I don't have time or I don't have the space to go out into the wilderness, or maybe I do, but I want to work with this plant instead, it's a very quick way to get back to that sense of cosmic immediacy, like we were talking about. It's a way to get back into this sense of like just seeing everything as it is and the miracle that it is, and releasing and letting go of all of the normal neuroses that I may be caught in at any point, and to, with ceremony, with trusting the plant, with treating the plant as a thou, as an intelligent being, an incredible way of experiencing the world opens up. And and I found that with Huachuma, it's very easy to integrate that. The experience is with me long after I can remember everything or almost everything. And it's easy to start to reshape my world according to that intelligence, which maybe just as simple as knowing what to say no to and just doing less or being more fully present. So yeah, I'll just leave it at that. But I very much hope that these plant medicines are continue to grow. I mean, I think there's a psychedelic revolution happening, and I just hope that continues and that people really take a respectful stance with them and don't just use them as an it and to make, you know, to have a great time, or those things are great. But there's so much more that can be experienced, and it involves us stepping into that relationship of treating the world, treating the earth, the universe as we'd want to be treated. You know, that's, I think, the only religious teaching that the golden rule that's really needed for me. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Is there anything else that you want to say about just wilderness, about the wild?
Well, we are the wild, and while there isn't a direct distinction, making the space to be wild, to as Thomas Berry says, incendence, to go into our primal body, into our most basic organizing principles. Going out into the wilderness can be helpful to find that, but my hope is that we and I begin to cultivate that and cultivate it more fully in every single facet of life, because I think that there's a way to do everything that we're doing as human beings, but from a completely different place and in a way that's not harmful to the earth and to life. And I think that's, for me, that's the most important thing. And I don't think we're going to survive unless we learn that.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Skylar Wilson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.